Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today we take you to Mid-Coast Forum at Point Lookout in Northport for a talk given by Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan. Professor Cole seeks to answer the question, does President Trump have a policy toward the greater Middle East? The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is George Look, president of Mid-Coast Forum.
So good afternoon, and welcome to the September meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. This is our 402nd meeting, and comes to you today from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I would like to give a special welcome to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. I'm George Look, the president of the Forum. Forum was founded in 1983 and is now in its 35th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomacy. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum is honored to have Juan Cole speak to us today on the question, does President Trump have a policy toward the greater Middle East? Juan Cole is the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. For three decades, he has sought to put the relationship of the West and the Muslim world in historical context. He was a regular guest on the PBS NewsHour and has appeared on ABC Nightly News, Nightline, The Today Show, Charlie Rose, and a whole big long list of other programs. Very impressive. He has written extensively about Egypt, Iran, Iraq, and South Asia. He has commented extensively on Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, the Iraq War, the politics of Pakistan and of Afghanistan, and Iranian domestic struggles in foreign affairs. Professor Cole continues to study and write about contemporary Islamic movements. He has a regular column at the news website Truthdig, and you can follow his most recent commentary on his website, juancole.com, which is titled Informed Comment, Thoughts on the Middle East, History, and Religion. Juan lived in various parts of the Muslim world for nearly 10 years and continues to travel there widely. He has authored several books on the relationship of the West and the Muslim world, and his most recent of which, The New Arabs, How the Wired and Global Youth of the Middle East is Transforming It, was published by Simon & Schuster in 2014. It's my pleasure to welcome Professor Cole to the Mid-Coast Forum. Juan, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much for that warm introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's not my first time. I was looking in my email archives, and I have addressed the Mid-Coast Forum at least one other time in 2011 in the wake of the Arab Spring protests. I think maybe another time too. But I first came for the Camden Conference in 2005. My subject today, the title is unwise on my part, because the question is asked, does Trump have a Middle East policy? They say that an orator should never ask a question the answer to which he does not know. This is dangerous, and so I have been unwise in that regard, because finding policy coherence in this young administration is something that's been beyond my powers. It's always the case, of course, in any administration that there's a certain amount of struggle. We all know, you know, the CIA, the Defense Department, the State Department often are not all on the same page. So that's no different in this administration, I think. But usually in the past, if someone asked me, even about a president that I completely despised, what do you think he would do about X, or she would do about X? We haven't had any she's. I would feel comfortable, usually, in saying, well, given the person's policy positions on that issue, this is what's likely to happen. And I'm usually right. But in this case, I have no idea. So let me just review what I can about the policy towards the Middle East in particular, and discuss where I think things may be going. One big change we can see between the Obama administration and the Trump administration has to do with Iran. Obama came into office after the disaster of the Iraq War, determined to pull out of the Middle East. He felt like that's an area where the United States really doesn't have that many interests and no good deed goes unpunished, and that it would be much better if we could just get out. He didn't seem to want to take responsibility for this change, however. He said the tides of war are ebbing, as though he's not the commander-in-chief who would decide whether the tides of war ebbed or not. But that was his approach, and one unfinished piece of business on the table was Iran and its nuclear enrichment program. That had been, for, I think, the Dick Cheney group in the Bush administration, a casus belli, a reason for which the United States might go to war with Iran. And one forgets now in the heady days of 2003 when the U.S. was the sole superpower, unchallenged throughout the world, the Soviet Union had collapsed, Russia was supine, the Chinese were busy making money, sort of said to the United States, knock yourselves out, have all the adventures you like, bankrupt yourselves, we'll still be here. At that time, Washington was ebullient, and when the Bush administration came in, they thought they could reshape the world. They would get rid of the what they saw as the last remnant of the old Stalinist regimes in the Middle East, such as that of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And, you know, some have alleged that they had a list of seven countries they were going to reformulate. And there was this saying that, you know, everybody wants to go to Baghdad. Real men want to go to Tehran. So that Iran piece of the puzzle was on the table when Obama came in. And he was determined to remove it from the table, to have it not be an ongoing prospect that the United States would have war with Iran. And, you know, it is a little bit peculiar. I don't particularly care for the comedian Bill Maher, but occasionally he gets things right. And he says that the United States is an odd sort of country where we kind of have a list of countries that we expect sometime or another we will destroy. So Iran was high on that list. What to do about Iran's nuclear enrichment program? What Obama did was to put, as of 2012, in his second administration, extremely severe economic sanctions on Iran, amounting really to a financial blockade. The United States Treasury Department went around the world and strong-armed other countries about doing business with Iran. So Iran was kicked off of the currency exchanges. There's a South Asia currency exchange so that Pakistan and Nepal and India can all buy and sell from one another. Iran had been on it, kicked off. It was kicked off all the major bank exchanges in Europe, of course, North America. And so it became extremely difficult for Iran to sell its oil because how would people pay for it? They were reduced to barter with India. They would take rupees and they would promise to buy Indian goods in return for their oil. They were doing $5 billion, $10 billion a year in trade with South Korea. $5 billion, the South Koreans would buy Iranian oil and $5 billion the Iranians would buy cars and other goods from South Korea. That went to almost zero under Obama. Of course, South Koreans got hurt too. And the United States went to Saudi Arabia and said, you know, could you pump not 9.5 million barrels a day, but 10.5, even 11 million barrels a day to flood the market, to make up for the oil that the United States was taking off the market from Iran. Iran had been producing 4 million barrels a day of petroleum, exporting 2.5 million. That went down under Obama to 1.5 million. And petroleum is 70% of Iran's income. So this really hurt Iran. When in 2013 Hassan Rouhani was elected, he's a centrist. He comes from a section of the Islamic Republic that's willing to make a deal. He's not a reformer, not a leftist, none of the things the press often says about him, but a centrist, a pragmatic person, and had been involved in nuclear negotiations with Europe in 2003 and 2004. I imagine the scenario that Rouhani is elected. He goes in to see the leader. Our press calls him the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, but they don't say supreme in Persian. is just rahbar, is just leader. I think we have to project on these countries we don't like evil words. Supreme, who has a supreme leader? It's a villain, obviously. But he went in to see the leader. I think he said, you know, after the trouble they had in summer of 2009 in the previous election, that the regime felt shaken. People had come out against it, and the economic sanctions were so severe. Middle class was hurting. And I think Rouhani said, you know, look, we have to make a deal. And what was the deal about was Iran's nuclear enrichment program. Now, nuclear enrichment is a very complex subject. I want to advertise as loudly as I can that I am not a nuclear physicist. Nevertheless, as far as I can tell as a historian, Iran was not actually trying to make a bomb. And I think had they been trying to make a bomb, they would have made one by now. This is like North Korea wanted a bomb, they have a bomb. It's not that hard if you're a nation and you have engineers and you can buy the materials and so forth. I think they didn't want a bomb. So why were they enriching uranium? Well, I think it was dual use. One is they wanted people to know that they could make a bomb. You know, why would you have a bomb is for deterrence. It's not an offensive weapon. It's to make sure that the other guy doesn't attack you. And after the United States invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, and those of you who know geography will understand that Iran is right in the middle of those two, you could imagine the Ayatollahs in Tehran being a little nervous about the United States moving in on them next. And that the people around Dick Cheney openly said that that's what we're going to do couldn't have helped allay that anxiety. So everybody knows that the Japanese could make a bomb if they wanted to. They're good at technology. They have 4 tons of plutonium reserves. That seems to me like an awful lot of plutonium to just have in the warehouse. I wouldn't even advise that, but that's what they've got. So presumably they could make a lot of bombs, and presumably they could make them pretty quickly. And everybody knows that, which is why North Korea won't actually do anything to them and why China won't move on them. And they also have, of course, an American nuclear umbrella. But the main thing is that they could have a bomb pretty quickly if they felt under threat. That's called the Japan option. Some of the academics who study these things call it nuclear latency. Well, that's what I think Iran wanted. They wanted the Japan option. And then they also actually use petroleum to generate electricity, which is inadvisable because then they can't sell it. And the more they use it domestically to make electricity, the less the money they have. So if you could replace that with nuclear, and this was happening at a time before the renewables became cheap enough to consider, then you could use less of your own oil and you could sell it abroad. So there were economic reasons to do it, but there were also geopolitical reasons to do it. When you say nuclear latency, however, that's actually not one thing. Because could a country make a bomb in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 months, a year? That actually matters quite a lot. And so I think the United States and Europe and the Security Council of the UN decided was Iran could keep its nuclear latency. It could have the Japan option. But it can't have a one-month option. It can't have a six-month option. It can't have an eight-month option. Now, how would you determine that option? How would you determine how long it takes to make a bomb? Well, they make them through centrifuges. Naturally occurring uranium, thank God, doesn't blow up very easily. But if you inject it with extra protons and neutrons and so forth, you can change its character so it becomes volatile. And so if you put radioactive gas in a centrifuge and swirl it around and inject the uranium with extra material, it becomes fissile. You change it, and the naturally occurring uranium is, I think, 238. You make it 235, it blows up. So they use centrifuges to do this. And that's how Pakistan made its bomb, was centrifuges. This is not something that can be hidden from people, because if you have, like, thousands of centrifuges running, it's noticeable. You could even see it from satellite. You can notice the use of water and electricity. The idea that you could hide a program like that seems to me implausible. In fact, when Pakistan was doing it in the 80s, I was in Pakistan in the 80s, and I asked the consul in Lahore, I said, what are you guys going to do about Pakistan's nuclear program? He said, we said, don't assemble it. We needed Pakistan to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan at the time, so we let them have it, basically, the United States. They didn't make a big deal out of it. My brother-in-law was in USAID at the time, and he got lost outside of Islamabad driving and coming back home, and he came to a checkpoint, and the guy at the checkpoint said, sir, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm trying to get to Islamabad. I seem to have gotten off on the wrong road. He said, sir, this is Kahuta. We are making an atomic bomb here. You can't be here. So that's how big a secret it was. So that's what Iran was doing. It was running all these centrifuges in Natanz outside of Isfahan, and they can be bombed. So then they started digging into a side of a mountain near Qom to put some more there. And what the Obama administration basically did was say, you can't have 20,000 centrifuges because then you could enrich enough uranium for a bomb too quickly. You can only have 6,000 centrifuges. And then you can also make a bomb with a heavy water reactor because the fissile material builds up on the rods they put in to cool the water. That's maybe how North Korea got theirs, the breeder reactor. So Iran was going to make a heavy water reactor, and Obama said you can't have one. As a result of this negotiation, they bricked up the reactor at Arak. They don't have it. It's not going to be there. They reduced the number of the centrifuges they had. They destroyed their stockpile of uranium enriched to 19.5% for their one of their medical reactors. And they accepted intensive ongoing inspections for 15 years by the International Atomic Energy Agency. So the avenues to a bomb were closed off by this deal. Actually, this was a very good deal for the United States. It allayed any fears of an Iranian nuclear program. And the Iranians did it to get economic relief because the whole world was boycotting them. And they've gotten nothing from this, almost nothing, because the Congress actually put extra sanctions on them in the aftermath. And then the Europeans are afraid that our Treasury Department would come after them. We have fined HSBC, for instance, billions of dollars for doing business with Iran. So the Congress kind of has its own foreign policy, and it tried to undermine Obama's diplomatic achievement and John Kerry's. The Trump administration, Trump has said over and over again that he thought it was a very bad deal. He doesn't say why he thinks these things. He doesn't actually seem to understand the deals. He keeps saying he has to pull out of the Paris Accords because the terms of it are too onerous for the United States. The Paris Accords is a very woolly, soft instrument that says each country should set its own goals. So no terms are being imposed on Mr. Trump by the Accords. He's supposed to decide which terms he likes. He doesn't have to withdraw from it to avoid those terms. Likewise, with the nuclear deal, he doesn't seem to understand that the Iranian nuclear enrichment program is a shadow of its former self and under very severe constraints because of these inspections. And, you know, the inspections can't be evaded. If somebody produces plutonium, there's no way, you know, you can't put air freshener and try to get rid of that signature. It will still be there a year later, and they can find it, the signature from plutonium. The Iranians really have given up everything in this regard. They've given up a lot of their Japan option because now they're known not to be able to make a bomb for many months, and you could invade them in the meantime. And then they haven't really gotten very much economic relief, so what exactly has this done for them? Whereas the United States got everything it wanted. But Trump wants to undermine this deal, and so one of the things that they're going to do is that they've announced that U.S. Congress is going to certify whether Iran is in compliance with the nuclear deal. This is not part of the deal. There's nothing in the language that the U.S. I mean, this is a deal between Iran and the United Nations Security Council plus Germany, and Germany kind of representing the EU. Obviously, Congress can complain about this, that, or the other thing and gradually undermine the deal, and it's already undermining it by refusing to take the sanctions off. We're likely to see a good deal of trouble between the United States and Iran if Mr. Trump goes through with this undermining of the nuclear deal. The policy towards Syria and Iraq and the fight against ISIL really continues under Trump what the Obama administration was doing without very much change. And that's not a big surprise because the people in charge of this policy are Jim Mattis, Secretary of Defense, who had been in Iraq as a general, H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, who had been in Iraq as a general, and I presume, although he's mainly in charge of the White House staff right now, that John Kelly is not without his influence on these policies, and he had also been in Iraq as a general. So the Iraq policy was potentially disrupted when Trump announced, or Steve Bannon apparently put together this plan for a Muslim visa ban soon after he came in late January, which included Iraq as among the countries where people would not be given visas. And since we are allied with the Iraqi military, training it and providing it with air support in the fight against ISIL, and together the United States and the Iraqi military have taken Mosul back from ISIL, which was their major city, just this spring, it would be highly inconvenient if those generals can't come to Fort Bragg and consult with their colleagues because they are under a Muslim visa ban. And the morale implications of this kind of thing are also extreme. So this proto-fascist bloc within the White House of Bannon and Miller and others was getting in the way of Iraq policy. And my guess is, without being an insider, that McMaster and Mattis moved them out and adjusted the policy so Iraq is no longer in the visa ban. But the general policy of training Iraqi counterterrorism brigades, deploying them with U.S. Air cover, and taking back all the territory from ISIL that it had gained in 2014, that policy, that strategy, is basically the one that Ash Carter and Obama had worked out with Haider al-Abadi, the prime minister of Iraq. Likewise, in Syria, Trump said that we should just give Syria to Putin if he wants it and let him take care of it. And that's basically what's being done. It's kind of already what Obama had de facto done, right? So the United States was giving some aid to the rebels, but was increasingly, I think, disturbed by the move of the rebels towards al-Qaeda, and some of them actually pledged allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, one of the masterminds of the 9/11 attacks. So, you know, that was politically uncomfortable to be allied with the people who were allied with them. Obama did give some aid to those rebels. Now they're saying maybe as much as $2 billion worth after 2013. But actually, in the larger picture of Syria, that wasn't that much money. Iran and Russia put in way more than that behind the regime. So I think it was unacceptable from Obama's point of view to let ISIL just remain there in the east of Syria. The Syrian government didn't have ISIL as on this front burner because they were out there in the eastern desert and they weren't really threatening Damascus, and it was the al-Qaeda-linked groups who were allied to some of the U.S.-backed rebels that were the main problem from Damascus's point of view, and those were the ones that the Russians bombed the bejesus out of when they came in 2015, 2016. So what Obama did was, he needed somebody to fight on the ground to whom we could give air support. And the only people in the region, nobody was interested in fighting ISIL in the region. The Saudis seemed to have thought, well, you know, they kill Shiites, they're against Iran, so that's good, leave them there. The Turks thought, well, they kill Kurds, they're good, leave them there. And even John Kerry admits that early on when ISIL took over eastern Syria, he said, well, good, they killed the Syrian army, they leave them there. So it was very hard to find somebody who was willing to fight them, but finally they found that the Kurds would, and so the U.S. had been backing the Kurds. And these are leftist Kurds, the Noam Chomsky Kurds. And they are very good at killing ISIL, and they don't like ISIL at all, as you can imagine. If you've heard Noam Chomsky talk about ISIL. That has succeeded as a policy. Now about half of Raqqa, the ISIL capital, has in eastern Syria, has been taken by the Kurds. It made Turkey really furious. It's not made Syria very happy either. But this is just a continuation of Obama policy. Trump didn't change that. In the wider Middle East, just to finish up, Obama, I think, came in reacting against Bush's determination, kind of muscular Wilsonianism, to bring the democracy to the Middle East, whether they liked it or not. At least that was the cover story. And Obama backed off from that. He was much more of a kind of Bush senior realist, so was not really interested in pressuring these countries to democratize. But Trump has gone even further in that direction. He actively wants strongmen in power. So he says, you know, Bashar al-Assad, not a great guy, but maybe that's what the Arabs need, as a strong hand. I'm not sure he has seen Bashar's chin. He thinks of him as a strong man. And if Putin and Bashar want to oppress the Syrians, then that's fine. And likewise, Sisi in Egypt, Trump gets along with famously. And that regime in Egypt has become a torturing, persecuting regime of a sort much more extreme than had been the case under Mubarak. On the other hand, Obama also let Sisi get away with all that stuff and, you know, continued the aid. The State Department about 3 weeks ago announced that it was considering cutting off aid to Egypt because of its severe human rights violations. I can't tell you who is responsible for this announcement. Clearly was not Donald Trump, didn't come in a tweet, didn't have any authoritarian background. I can't imagine that it was Rex Tillerson either, though. He hasn't really made a big deal out of human rights. As long as the oil comes out, Exxon is happy. So I presume it's some low-level Obama holdover who, since nobody's in charge, has decided to make this announcement. And I don't know if it will go anywhere. The Egyptians, I have to tell you, are extremely confused because they thought, you know, they asked Trump, are you okay with us, like, torturing all these people and arresting the journalists and nationalizing the newspapers? And Trump said, well, knock yourself out. And then the State Department, somebody in it seems to want to take away their aid for doing these things. So the bigger answer to my question of whether Trump has a Middle East policy is, it's too soon to tell. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So now we're going to grill you for a little while. I wondered if you'd comment. You talked about latent nuclear states, about the increasing dangers associated with an increasing number of nations with this latent nuclear capability.
Yeah. Well, of course, nuclear weapons are extremely destructive, and more destructive, I think, than most people realize. Back in the 80s, I saw a debate between Carl Sagan, the science popularizer, and Henry Kissinger. Nuclear war came up in the course of this debate. It was on PBS. Sagan says, well, our calculations are now indicating to us that in a nuclear exchange, there's a real danger of nuclear winter, that so much dust would be thrown up into the atmosphere. It would be like when that meteor, the Chicxulub meteor struck in 62 million years ago and made the dinosaurs extinct, that so much dust would be thrown up by these nuclear exchanges that it would cause the sunlight not to reach the grass and you'd have a die-off of the plants. And the crocodiles and the frogs seem to have survived the Chicxulub meteor, but that was it. And then these little furry mammals, who are our ancestors. It killed off the big animals. So Henry Kissinger was extremely annoyed, I remember, at Carl Sagan for bringing this up. He said, I don't think it's useful for the public to hear this. So we should discourage nuclear proliferation. Trump, the candidate, seemed to be very enthusiastic about nuclear proliferation, was encouraging South Korea, Japan, everybody and his uncle to get a nuclear bomb so as to allow the United States to withdraw its nuclear umbrella and to withdraw from the world and be isolated. And that's coming from the Bannon wing of the Trump movement. That wing has now been exiled back to Santa Monica, still maybe has some advocates inside the administration. I think that the Obama nuclear deal with Iran is the way forward, because what Obama said to Iran through the severe sanctions was, you seem to be going in this direction, therefore you will be reduced to the Stone Age. You will not have a middle class. You will not sell your commodities. Severe instability could ensue if government officials are mostly concerned about staying in power, and that wasn't clear that they could do so under those circumstances. And then the second part of that was, well, here's how you could get back out of our vice. This is how you could escape this trap, by making sure that whatever nuclear latency you have, because you can't take back the knowledge once it exists, is nevertheless difficult to deploy and over the long term. And this is why, if Trump succeeds in undermining the Iran nuclear deal, that could encourage proliferation, because people would say, well, they're not dealing with us in an upright way. We can't trust them. And moreover, if the United States were to undermine the nuclear deal and then invade Iran, then all of the countries in the world that we might invade would decide that they'd better go ahead and have a nuclear weapon quick, because we didn't invade North Korea, despite our president's promise of fire and fury like nobody has ever seen. We won't see that, because nobody's crazy enough. I called it trying to strangle a rattlesnake with one hand tied behind your back. That's what it would be like to go against a nuclear-armed state. I think this determination on the part of Trump and of significant elements in the Republican Party to undermine the Iran nuclear deal is a severe danger to the world, because it would encourage proliferation.
Thank you. We've got a couple here on Kurdistan, the simplest being, what are the prospects of a Kurdistan? Another one being, will Kurdistan cover both Iraq and Syria, or will Turkey keep it from happening?
Well, I have the severest doubts that there will be a Kurdistan, because any group of people can announce that they're a state. It doesn't do them very much good unless the rest of the world recognizes it. There would be embassies, there would be trade agreements. There's no prospect of anybody recognizing the Kurdish state that Mr. Barzani wants to establish in northern Iraq. In fact, the Kurds exported some petroleum through a pipeline to Turkey from a field which had not been authorized by the Iraqi Ministry of Petroleum. And a ship showed up with that Kurdish petroleum at Houston, and the Iraqi government sued, and the judge ruled for Iraq. So just a little example of how you can declare all the things you want to declare, but unless the world's institutions acknowledge you, then it's very difficult to make it go forward. Iran does not want Iraqi Kurdistan to become an independent country, because it has 4 million Kurds who are a fairly compact region of northwest Iran itself, and they have exhibited some secessionist tendencies. Back in the 80s, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards killed a number of these Kurds. And then Turkey does not want it, because 20% of Turkey is Kurdish, and they're terrified that Eastern Anatolia will secede. So you have a region full of Lincolns who are being faced with a Fort Sumter. Why did Lincoln win that one? Well, the North was industrialized and populous and organized, and the South was, let's face it, plantations. And the same thing is true in the Middle East. The countries that have the big, powerful militaries, Turkey, Iran, not so much Syria and Iraq, but nevertheless more than the Kurds, all don't want this to happen. If an attempt is made, as Barzani seems to want, then I think it just will fail. It will fail internationally, and it will be undermined by the local powers.
What policies do you expect the Trump administration to have toward the Israelis?
Yeah. I think Trump doesn't understand the situation in Israel and Palestine. He doesn't understand that the West Bank is being occupied by the Israelis. And a lot of Americans don't know this. They think the Palestinians are occupying the Israelis and being mean to them. they're being mean to each other, but who is being occupied is pretty clear. But this is not widely understood, and I think Trump does not understand it. And the one time he's talked about this, he had Netanyahu and Abbas, and he said, you know, I've always been in favor of a two-state solution. Now you guys are talking about a one-state solution. They're not. And then he's saying, well, if that's what you want, do you want to do that deal, I'll be glad to help you do it. I mean, it was like somebody had arrived from Mars, didn't know. Both the PLO and the Israelis only hang on by pretending that there is a peace process and that there could be a two-state solution. This is highly unlikely to occur, and it's probably all over with, and some kind of one-state solution is the most likely outcome, although ethnic cleansing of all the Palestinians is also a possibility. But in any case, Trump didn't display, let us say, any firm knowledge of the issues when he spoke about it. But then his strongman tendency is that Bibi Netanyahu talks like a tough guy, and he likes that. He likes tough guys, except when they're on the other side. So he dismissed Biden as a tough guy. I think the actual situation is that Netanyahu could, you know, do whatever he liked, any illegal thing, and get away with it from Trump's point of view. Unfortunately for Mr. Netanyahu, this is not true of the Israeli police.
Let's stick with Israel for just a second, because you have a couple others related to that. One of them is, this morning's news has Netanyahu wishing to talk to Trump about Iran. What do you think he wants to tell Trump, and what do you think Trump's going to do? And the second one is, if the Iran deal achieves its goal of preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons in the short term, why is Israel so adamantly opposed to it?
Okay. So Israel doesn't want Iran to have the Japan option because nuclear latency is already a geopolitical fact. Israel is the only nuclear-armed country in the Middle East. It is, therefore, at the top of the pile. And the Israelis are not shy, if they feel threatened, about reminding people. They don't say it openly. They won't discuss their nuclear stockpile, but they have a couple hundred warheads. When Bush invaded Iraq in 2003, the Israelis let Iraq know that you'd better not, as you did during the Gulf War, send any missiles over onto us, or Baghdad just won't be there. Again, they said it in a more diplomatic way, but that's what was intended to be conveyed. They don't want Iran to have nuclear latency. So Obama extending Iran's nuclear latency so that breakout happens at 8 months rather than at 2 months, that means nothing to the Israelis. They just don't want them to have it at all. Well, our Pentagon has looked at this issue and back before the nuclear deal and made a report to Obama that there really is only one way to stop Iran from having nuclear latency, which is to invade it and occupy it. That's the only way you could dismantle all that stuff. I mean, I suppose you'd have to, like, imprison the nuclear scientists or assassinate them or something. But you'd have to be in control in order to destroy that capability. Iraq didn't go well, and it's a third the population and a third the geographical size of Iran. So that's a tall order to occupy Iran. It's not a tall order for the Israelis to wish we would, and that's what Mr. Netanyahu wants to talk about to Trump about.
To what extent did the Iraq war, U.S. invasion of Iraq, create the situations present in the Middle East today?
The Iraq war destabilized Iraq. It created severe discontents among the Sunni Arab population in Iraq. Iraq is about 60% Shiite Arab, 22% Kurdish. Those are mostly Sunni Muslims, but they don't speak Arabic. They speak an Indo-European language, related ultimately to English. I figure on the order of 17% Sunni and Arab. The Sunni Arabs get angry at me when I say this. They don't, because they lived under totalitarian regimes, they don't have a good sense of social statistics. The parliamentary elections that have occurred in Iraq, I think they show these proportions are about right. So the Sunni Arabs, however, had been the ruling elite, Iraq, and they were dethroned by the United States, and quite deliberately. The Bush administration policy was to ally with the Kurds and the Shiites, and to be vindictive and punitive towards the Sunni Arabs. So they were all fired from their government jobs, and their factories were deliberately closed, and they were reduced to nothingness after having been in control of the country. Well, I tell people, you know, if somebody invaded the United States, God forbid, they did that to the West Point graduates and the Harvard MBAs, you know, the elite of the United States, what do you think those people would do? Getting a hold of C4 explosives is not that hard. The Sunni Arabs of Iraq, a proportion of them, a significant proportion of them, have been turned into revolutionaries as a result of what was done to them. And some of them are secular revolutionaries and some of them are religious revolutionaries. But basically, they're pragmatic. They're desperate. Anybody who will save them from this situation of being dominated by the Shiites of the South, which is what they were being, was happening to. There were, even in the Obama period, in the 2012, 2013, there were villages of Sunni Arabs who were not happy with the government, who were actually taking artillery fire fairly frequently. So that chased them into the arms of ISIL. ISIL shows up, they say, we can liberate you from the Shiites. We kill Shiites. And most Iraqi Sunnis, you know, are secular-minded people. They're not religious fanatics. In fact, my colleague Mark Tesler was doing opinion polling. In 2012, he asked the Iraqis, you know, do you believe in a separation of church and state, or religion, mosque and state? 75% of the people in the Sunni Arabs in Iraq, people in Mosul and so forth, said yes, there should be a separation of religion and state. Only 55% of Shiites said that. The Tom Paines of Iraq are the Sunnis. And how ironic that they should end up with a caliphate. But it was pragmatic. The ISIL people came back over from Syria. They said, we can liberate you from Nouri al-Maliki, who's oppressing you. They said, yeah, anything but Nouri al-Maliki. Now they have rethought, and this is not anything but Nouri al-Maliki. They're very happy to be liberated from ISIL. But so that destabilized Iraq, and it's destabilized until this moment. It gave a fillip to the Kurdish secessionism, and then it traveled over in Syria because part of the Syrian civil war was ISIL people coming over from Iraq who were very good. They'd seasoned fighters, had fought the Marines, knew their way around weaponry, and they were the ones who came up with the idea to take the small forward operating bases, the FOBs in Syria of the Syrian Arab Army, which were lightly manned, and then you could get their weapons that were stored there. So the Syrian civil war was certainly prolonged and made much more violent. 400,000 people, we think, have been killed, 4 million displaced, externally half the country displaced if you take internal displacement into account. That all, you know, was contributed to by the destabilization of Iraq by the United States. The PKK, the far-left Kurdish secessionists in eastern Anatolia, once Saddam fell, he had been keeping them out of Iraq. Once Saddam fell, they came in the Kandil Mountains and made bases. And so that whole issue of Kurdish secessionism started back up. And now in the last 2 years, Erdogan has been sending the army into these Kurdish villages and committing atrocities and destroying them and so forth. The Iraq element in that is relatively small, but certainly you could say that in 1999, it looked like the PKK was over. Öcalan, their leader, was in jail. And as soon as Iraq fell to Bush, all of a sudden the whole thing started back up. Ironically enough, because we did this to a NATO ally. I would say, yeah, it destabilized the eastern reaches of the Middle East.
There are so many rivalries in the Middle East that it's hard to cover all of them. But the one question is, could you please comment on the future of the relationship or not between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
That's a dark question. Saudi Arabia is in a transition. It's a country of, I figure, 20 million citizens. They claim a much larger population, but I don't trust them. They have about 6 or 7 million guest workers, but you know, you can't induct the Filipino maids into the military. The 20 million citizens are the ones that are relevant for geopolitics. And their richest Croesus, they have a sovereign wealth fund, and then they have currency reserves, estimated to be about $750 billion each. So they have $1.5 trillion in walking around money. not, they don't need that to run the government or build roads. Or that's separate from the budget of the country. And 20 million people. So, you know, we would be lucky to have a surplus of 1.5 trillion, and we're 320 million people. So that gives them a lot of power. And, of course, they're dominating economically. They've long since used their economic wealth to buy influence. So they would put $1 billion in the Lebanese Central Bank. Lebanon government would then do whatever they asked. They bought the Egyptian officer corps and so forth. Now, in the last 2 or 3 years, however, they've decided to flex their military muscles. And they've bought a lot of weapons from the United States, nice, new, shiny weapons. One of the things we historians think is that massive weapons purchases lead to war, because you have them and your enemy doesn't, but your enemy will if you wait 5 years. So the only point in buying them would be if you went ahead and used them while you had the advantage. So and then you have a generational change. A new generation is coming up. So Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, has moved out his rivals, and he's got his eye, I think, on his father's throne. And the father, you know, there's a lot of propaganda. It's hard to know, but some people say he's got some dementia and will be moved out. In any case, Mohammed bin Salman is in control of Saudi Arabia for all practical purposes. It was his idea to invade Yemen. We never saw Saudis invading other countries, I mean, since the 18th century, but now they're doing it. They have decided to pick a fight with Iran. Iran is the other power in their region that they're afraid of. Partly this has to do with a feeling of being surrounded, because Syria is pro-Iran. After Bush, Iraq is pro-Iran. I can't tell you how much the Saudis hate Bush for that. Iran is a country of nearly 80 million, also an oil power. And then there's a Sunni-Shiite thing going on. Actually, the Saudis are Wahhabis, not proper Sunnis, and they're very extreme against Shiites. But I think they could make a deal with the Shiites under other circumstances. This is mainly about geopolitics. So the Saudis want to flex their muscles. They want to dominate Yemen. They want to dominate Bahrain. Both of them have large Shiite populations that are pro-Iranian. They want to dominate Syria. They have been defeated in Syria. Iran won that one. They have been defeated in Lebanon. The Lebanese government won't talk to them anymore. And so they feel like, you know, Iran is coming for them. It's got them surrounded, and they're being reduced in their influence. So what they would really like is if only they could convince Mr. Trump to bomb Iran and break its legs. We've been reduced to being a capo, you know, we're the enforcer for the regional powers in the Middle East. Who knows? Could happen.
So then I want to switch gears a little bit on you. Instead of talking about specific countries, but one of the questions that came up is, what do you see as the potential U.S. policy and consequences of the refugee crisis in the Middle East?
Yeah. Well, the refugee crisis in the Middle East is quite severe. A great deal of it is Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. So somebody was asking, what was the outcome of our invasion of Iraq? Well, the refugee crisis is one of the outcomes. On the other hand, as we speak at this moment, I think we may be coming to the end of this particular wave of refugees from those countries, maybe with the exception of Afghanistan. Russia has won the civil war in Syria, and it's all over but the shouting. There's a few pockets, Idlib province in the north of the country, a few pockets of continued resistance, but for the most part, the regime has reasserted itself with the help of a lot of an influx of Shiite militias from other countries. You've got Pakistani Shiites, you've got Afghan Shiites, you've got Lebanese Shiites, there's a map that shows which parts of the country they're helping the regime nail down. But in any case, at the moment, you're not seeing people displaced any longer. And in fact, some people are coming back because it's no fun to be a refugee. If they can come back, if it's safe enough, they will. So there has been a reverse. And I saw this in Lebanon during the civil war in the 70s and 80s, that 400,000 Lebanese, and it's a small country of, at that time, 3 million, 400,000 Lebanese had been forced to Syria as refugees. They all came back, almost all of them, when it was safe to do so in the 90s and after. I think that's not appreciated as, of course, if they get really far away, the ones who went to Sweden probably not coming back, unless they're made to. Most of them would, the ones who went to Turkey, to Lebanon, and so forth, it was safe, they'll go back. And you start to see this happening now. So I actually think we're at the beginning of an end of that particular refugee crisis. Likewise, in Iraq, now the Iraqi government has taken back all the territory of ISIL except for Hawija near to Kurdistan and Qayyim in the northeast near to Syria. So it's not displacing people any longer. On the other hand, the Africa side of the refugee problem is still very lively. People coming up from Somalia, and you know, there's some Yemenis who are getting across the Red Sea and coming up through Sudan to Egypt and Libya. And the refugee crisis of the Mediterranean is a crisis of poor governance. If you have a strong government with the will, they can just forbid people to get in boats on the coast and go into the Mediterranean. It's only in places like Libya where the government has more or less collapsed. Nobody's doing that. But in Tunisia, for instance, the Tunisian government is doing a fairly good job. Turkey could do a good job because it is a NATO military and well-organized and fairly wealthy. But I think politically decided to let these coyotes, the gangs that run refugees into Europe, do so in order to blackmail Europe. And the Europeans came back to them and said, well, if we gave you $3 billion, would that be enough? Turks said, oh, yeah, we'll take that. So then, you know, somehow the refugee, you notice we don't see the headlines quite as much anymore. There's always danger the deal would break down. But, I mean, it shows that Turkey could stop it if it wanted to. So I think the going forward, the big issues will be failed states, so places like Libya from which a lot of the ships are now taking off.
Then let's do one final question, and for this we're going to ask you to look into your political crystal ball. And there were a couple of questions here. I'll read them both. One is, will Tillerson be pushed out, leave, or stay? And the second one, what about Mathis's role in policy issues such as Iran?
To take the second one first, Jim Mattis is an Iranophobe. I think he's actually a fairly sensible person, despite his nickname of Mad Dog. And I've heard him give talks like this one. You know, they put them on TV and you can watch them. And much of what he says seems to me right on the money. So I want to advertise that on the whole, I respect his opinion, and he has long experience in the Middle East. He's not a neophyte. He was in Iraq. But those Americans who were, I apologize if any of you are among them, who were running Iraq for 8.5 years, did see Iran as their rival because they were wooing the Iraqi Shiites. And the Iraqi Shiites, on the whole and by and large, you know, there are some nationalists among them, but on the whole and by and large, are very cozy with Iran. So when they got into trouble, when Nouri al-Maliki sent the army down to Basra in 2008 and couldn't make it stick, needed to go to negotiation with Muqtada Sadr, one of the opposition clerics, he brought in Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's Jerusalem brigades, the Iranian special ops, to be the mediator. He didn't go to the United States to be the mediator because the United States had no standing to mediate between two Shiite groups. And this drove the Americans crazy. Then Iran, you know, had an impact on party formation, elections, and this sort of thing. So the Americans who were in Iraq really felt like Iran was stealing Iraq from them while they were there. And I always thought it was the most amazing arrogance because, I mean, kind of like occupying Ireland and telling the Irish they're not allowed to talk to the Vatican. A bunch of Protestants. I mean, that's the British tried that, actually. It doesn't work. But there's an irrational hatred and fear of Iranians, I think, among that American social class that was trying to run Iraq. And I'm not saying it's not understandable, but it goes beyond just policy formation. There's something visceral about it. So I don't think Mattis likes Iran one little bit. I think he's very suspicious of it. I think he sees the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps and Qasem Soleimani as rivals of the United States, and I think he would like to break its legs. Well, the other one is Tillerson. Well, My question about that would just be, is he really there?
That's a good way to end. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan. He recently spoke at Midcoast Forum at Point Lookout in Northport. You can listen to the program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to access the program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. And for Speaking in Maine, I'm Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.